Yeah, it's going to be a little related. So, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here to give this talk. This is joint work with Ashwin Vishwanath at Berkeley. And so Michael covered a lot of the sort of introductory concepts that I'll need, but I'll still go through a few of them just to make sure we're on the same page, just because this is a sort of mixed audience of physicists and mathematicians. So the first point I want to make is, you know, just to set the stage, we're going to be talking about quantum systems. So there's a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian involved. And, you know, in all these quantum systems that I'll be thinking about, in the background, I'm going to be thinking about lattice quantum systems. That just means that, you know, for my purposes, the Hilbert space will be a tensor product of local site Hilbert spaces. And the Hamiltonian will be some sum of local terms or terms with some finite range. So this is sort of, you know, the universe in which all these phases that I'll be talking about exist. And later I'll be talking about, you know, various properties of these Hamiltonians, like the excitations that they support, and I'll be talking about point-like excitations or in higher dimensions loop-like excitations. And the point that I want to make is, you know, even though I'll be referring to point-like excitations, they'll actually, you know, they'll be at least as big as the lattice scale, typically bigger than the lattice scale. There's some correlation length. So this, you know, the lattice is always in the background somewhere, but it's sort of microscopically small. Good. So the next important point is that I'll be looking at gap, not just any quantum systems, but gapped quantum systems. So in other words, in the many-body spectrum, if I look at the many-body spectrum of my Hamiltonian, there's a gap between the ground state and the excited states that, you know, that remains constant as you take larger and larger system size. Later, I'll want to relax this a little bit. I will allow more than just one ground state. There might be some finite number of ground states and topological degeneracy, but basically, this is the picture. Now, you know, why do I want to make this why do I want to restrict myself to looking just at gapped Hamiltonians? Well, you know, there's lots of physically interesting systems that are gapped, but also, you know, gap systems are easier to study. So somehow, the physics of gap systems just reduces to the physics of the ground state, essentially. So, you know, if you have some system which is gapped and you probe it in various ways, but at energies or frequencies whose energies are much lower than this gap, then basically the system stays in the ground state, and you're really just looking at the physics of the ground state. So, so that's a simplification. Okay, good. So I'm going to be focusing on gapped ground states. And one other ingredient that's going to be important to me is symmetry. So I'm going to be looking at systems with symmetry. So for my purposes, the symmetry group, which I'll be considering, will always be a finite group. And it will always be a unitary on-site representation. So that means that each site Hilbert space forms a unitary representation of G, say the same unitary representation of G. And the global action of G is just given by tensor product of these site actions. And what I'm going to restrict myself looking at is Hamiltonians, gapped Hamiltonians, which commute with this action of symmetry. And furthermore, just as Michael did in the last talk, I'm going to assume that there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking. So all the phases that I'll talk about, there will not be any spontaneous symmetry breaking involved. All right. Good. So that's sort of the basic setting for this talk. The result that I'll talk about basically links sort of two disparate threads. Okay, so let me just describe these threads at some broad level, and then later I'll get into the details of what all these things mean. So one thread has to do with gapped quantum systems, gapped quantum Hamiltonians in 2+1 space-time dimensions. So, you know, because there's high energy people here, I'm including this plus one. This is two spatial dimensions, one time dimension. So looking at systems in 2+1 space-time dimensions, it is, you know, it's sort of accepted that such gapped phases are described by unitary modular tensor categories. That's sort of the mathematical description of these things. So, you know, roughly the idea is that if you just look at gapped phases, and forget about symmetry for a second, just look at gapped phases in two spatial dimensions, they might have some excitations which are topologically non-trivial. That just means they're local excitations in the sense that, you know, their energy is localized in some region. Everywhere else, it looks exactly like the ground state. The reduced density matrix looks like that of the ground state. But nevertheless, this excitation cannot be made with a local operator. So if you sort of take, you know, sort of all such localized excitations modulo the ones that can be made with local operators, that turns out to be, or is believed to be, a finite set of topological excitations, so-called anions. Okay, and in this mathematical description by modular tensor categories, these anions correspond to the simple objects of the modular tensor category, and sort of the remaining structure in the modular tensor category, like you know, grading and fusion associativity and so on, just basically encodes the various physical things that you can do to these anions, like grade or fuse. Okay, so that turns out to be the sort of correct mathematical description of just phases. There's also an extra ingredient, central charge, but that's not going to be important for what I talk about. Okay, so that's without symmetry. Now, if you include symmetry, so in other words, you know, if you include just say one universality class, one gapped phase corresponding to some modular tensor category, unitary modular tensor category. Now, if you impose symmetry, it turns out that you get a refined classification, and that one class splits into several symmetry enriched phases. Okay, and it turns out, and this is sort of recent work based on this paper by Edingoff, Niksic, and Ostrich. Recent work of, you know, a bunch of people, where the idea is that symmetry enriched phases, the sort of refinement of topological order in the presence of these kinds of symmetries, is described by braided G cross categories, so-called braided G cross categories, which extend A, which extend this unitary modular tensor category. So you know, later I'll talk a little bit more about what a braided G cross category is, insofar as it's important for my talk. But roughly, the idea is that you know, this extension of this, you know, the simple objects in A describe the anion excitations, and the simple objects in a given braided G crossed extension describe not only anions but also the symmetry fluxes, the G fluxes. Okay. So this turns out to be the correct structure for describing symmetry enriched phases. Now, you know, these various works try to construct a given braided G cross category. You know, so suppose that you're given a topological order A and you're given a group G. You know, you can ask the question of, well, how many different braided G cross extensions are there, and is there some, you know, nice way of classifying them? And so that's what these various works did. And it turns out that there's sort of a very nice sort of step-by-step construction of these braided G cross categories, where the idea is that you know, there's some finite number of stages, basically three stages, and in each stage you just specify some finite piece of data. Okay, and after its specification of this data, it turns out that sometimes there are braided G cross categories that correspond to that data, and you can sort of proceed to the next step. And sometimes there aren't. Sometimes there's obstructions. Okay. So let me leave that. Okay. So sometimes there are obstructions for set class in this classification of symmetry enriched phases, or in classification of braided G cross categories. So that's one thread. Now let me discuss a second, seemingly unrelated thread, which is looking at 3+1 space-time dimensions. So gapped Hamiltonians in 3+1 space-time dimensions. Okay. So here things are sort of a bit less well understood. So in fact, it's known that in 3+1 space-time dimensions there's some very strange gapped Hamiltonians. So I'm not going to say anything about a classification of gapped Hamiltonians in 3+1 dimensions, but certainly there are some interesting examples of 3+1 dimensional topological phases. And one such class of examples is gauge theories, and specifically discrete gauge theories. For me, actually, abelian discrete gauge theories. Okay. And so what's interesting about such 3+1 dimensional discrete gauge theories is that, as opposed to this two-dimensional setting, they contain not only particle-like or point-like excitations, but also loop-like excitations. Okay, that's a generic feature of these phases. So that's just describing a class of phases. So far, I haven't said anything about symmetry in this 3+1 dimensional setting. But now you might ask the question again, just as one did in 2+1D, what happens when you add symmetry, when you try to refine the classification with symmetry. So it turns out that the story here, at least for this class of phases, is in some sense similar to the story in 2 plus 1D. So you can characterize 3 plus 1 dimensional symmetry enriched phases by specifying certain data. So in particular, you know, I mentioned there were in 2 plus 1 dimensions, I mentioned there were sort of several steps, three steps that one takes. Basically, and I'll describe it in the next couple of slides. But basically, the idea is that the data that you choose is roughly, you know, how your symmetry permutes the different anion types. That's one piece of data. And another piece of data, it's very sort of coarse, rough level, is, you know, what fractional or what projective charge do the various anions carry? Okay, there could be some symmetry fractionalizations, and projective charges can be bound to these excitations. So that's also true in 3 plus 1 spacetime dimensions. But it turns out that there's sort of novel possibility in 3 plus 1 spacetime dimensions where, you know, even if the symmetry sort of doesn't permute any of the labels associated with labeling these particle-like or loop-like excitations, and even if there's no sort of fractional charge bound to any of them, there could still be some symmetry fractionalization. And this has to do with the fact that these loop-like excitations might have a symmetry fractionalization where basically they behave as edges of two-dimensional symmetry projective phases, two-dimensional SPT. So this is sort of a type of symmetry fractionalization that's only available in 3 plus 1D, not in 2 plus 1D. Okay? And it turns out that these two things are related. Okay, so the existence of, you know, these obstructions and this symmetry fractionalization along loops are related. And this is what I'll show in the rest of the talk. Okay, so, yeah.
The 3 plus 1 dimensional phase, it's not invertible. There's not a unique vector on every.
There's not. That's right, yeah. In fact, both of these cases, I was talking about, you know, topological phases with anions here, and 3 plus 1 dimensional phases with excitations. They're, neither of them is invertible.
Even without the symmetry?
Yeah, even without the symmetry, absolutely.
Before gauging, was it invertible?
Before gauging, no. No, it wasn't invertible. It had some topological order even before gauging. So yeah, so there's two ingredients. There's the gauge theory that I start with, and then there's another symmetry that I'll impose on top of it. I'll refer to symmetry fluxes versus gauge fluxes. Gauge fluxes are the things that are already there before gauging.
And another question. Yeah. 2 plus 1 dimensions, when you talk about the topologically ordered phase, yeah, about symmetry, there's a complete formalism. Some algebraic data like a model density category.
Right.
But in 3 plus 1, you don't have that.
I don't.
Description. So you're going to focus on some examples.
Yeah, I'm going to focus on a class of examples. This is, in fact, I'm going to focus on a class of examples in 2 plus 1 as well. I'm not characterizing the entire story. That's right. Absolutely. Yep. Good. Okay. So let me focus on the first thread, the 2 plus 1 dimensional story, and let me try to explain this obstruction idea in a little bit more detail. So suppose we have some kind of a topological order in two dimensions, okay, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and we try to classify the way in which a symmetry might sort of interact with that topological order. So at the absolute coarsest level, you know, what you could look at is how the symmetry group G permutes the anion labels. So in other words, you know, just think of a global state which has, you know, this is a state that looks like the ground state ever, except has like an anion A here, you know, and maybe an anion A bar here to make the total topological charge trivial. They're well separated, you know. Let's look at this configuration. If I act globally with the symmetry on this entire state, that could go into a state where the topological class of this excitation A gets changed. Okay. So there's some induced permutation on these anion labels. Okay, so there's a map from G to the permutations of the anions. Now, of course, there's a lot more structure than that. We don't just have the anion labels. We have this entire unitary modular tensor category that describes your topological order. And so more precisely, sort of at this coarse level, what you have is not just a map from G to the permutations of the anions, but rather a map from G, the group G, to another group, which is this group of braided autoequivalences of this modular tensor category up to isomorphisms. Okay, this is a coarse piece of data. So what do I mean? Well, You know, for instance, you can't just take any permutation. The symmetry action must commute with fusion, for instance. Okay, so there are some restrictions on the kinds of permutations that you can get. And furthermore, you know, the symmetry doesn't act only on, you know, this is sort of not the only action of the symmetry. The symmetry, you know, also acts on the local operators in your theory. So in particular, fusion operators, which fuse anions. So in category theory language, this gives rise to a functor, and you know, that functor has to have all these nice properties with respect to fusion, with respect to tensoring, and with respect to braiding. So it turns out to be an invertible braided tensor functor from A to itself. So that's what a braided autoequivalence is. In fact, a groupoid of these things, but I can just focus on the underlying group, which is the group of braided autoequivalences of the anions up to isomorphism. There's a well-defined notion of isomorphism. What G is? Big G is the symmetry group of my system, so it's an on-site unitary. It's a global symmetry. It's a global symmetry. Okay, so this is sort of a coarse piece of data that can characterize your action of the symmetry. This is sometimes referred to as anionic symmetry. Okay, this map from G to this gamma one group of braided autoequivalences. So now you can sort of ask a reasonable question, which is, well, you know, it seems like any group map from G to gamma one sort of respects all the topological properties of the phase. So can any such group map be realized in a physical system? Okay, and just, you know, is there a physical Hamiltonian realization of which has that corresponding map from G to gamma one? I call that map pi hat. And it turns out that surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, but it turns out that the answer is no. Okay, and there's an obstruction that you can compute. So there's an algebraic quantity that you can compute that only depends on G. It depends on your chosen map pi hat, and it depends on the unitary modular tensor category, and it's valued in this object. So A invertible is the subset of abelian anions in your theory, which is actually a subgroup under abelian subgroup under abelian group under fusion.
How pi hat anchoring?
Let me discuss that later, because I have a few slides on it. Yeah. Okay, good. So in fact, and again, this is all work on based on this work by Edinghoff, Niksic, and Ostrich. So it turns out there's a class of examples of such obstructed pi hats that you can construct. And this class of examples is based on a class of examples in group theory, so-called Eilenberg-MacLane obstructions. Okay, so let me just describe the group. So this slide just talks about group theory. You know, there's no Hamiltonians, no physics in this slide. This is literally just a group theory slide. And so let me just describe this Eilenberg-MacLane obstruction. So here, the setting is that I have a finite group H, which is non-abelian, so finite non-abelian group H, with some non-trivial center z, and the fact that the center is non-trivial will become important. So in this setting, you know, suppose that you have the following data. Suppose that you have an extension, and remember, g is still my finite symmetry group, but here it's just a group. There's no symmetries. So here, suppose that you have this data. Suppose that you have an extension of g by h. Okay, so this is, you know, this is an so-called exact sequence, but physically, I mean, it encodes some pretty simple data. So basically, the idea is that this group E contains H as a normal subgroup, and the quotient of E by H is G. Okay, so given this data, there's some other data that I can pull out from this, and that's an action of G. It's a group map from G to automorphisms of H modulo inner automorphisms of H. Okay, so this is the so-called group of outer automorphisms. So the way you go from this top box to this bottom box is basically, you know, okay, so I'm supposed to produce a group map from G to the outer automorphisms of H. Given any G, what I do is I take a lift in E, and then I look at the conjugation map. That's a well-defined automorphism of H. And there's an ambiguity, you know, because there's an ambiguity in the lift, There's an ambiguity in the lift by multiplication by H. There's an ambiguity in this automorphism by conjugation by H, which is just an interim automorphism. So that's the data. Now you can ask the reverse question. You know, okay, so this data produce this data. Now can you do the reverse? Given a map from G to other automorphisms, is there always an exact sequence that induces it? And it turns out that there isn't, okay? And maybe later I can talk about sort of exactly why, but it turns out that has to do with the center of H being non-trivial, and the obstruction, you know, is just a function of this data, and it's valued in H3G with coefficients in Z. Okay, and it basically has to do with the fact that, you know, this H3 suggests that there's an associativity involved, and it basically has to do with the fact that you really can't define an associative multiplication in this extension. No matter how hard you try, there's some irremovable obstruction to defining an associative multiplication. And that ambiguity is by the center of H. Okay, basically because the center doesn't show up under conjugation. Okay, good.
So this map is the one of chain of cocycle in this H3. This is T.
What's that? Sorry?
So you say there's so how the data are reflected in H3? You say there's the evaluation of
How do you go from this data to H3? How do you produce the co-cycle class?
That's the insight. So this data describe us a particular co-cycle in H3.
Yeah, so exactly. From this data, you produce a particular co-cycle in H3. Yeah, and so roughly the way you do it is, what you do have to do is look at pairs of group elements, G1 and G2. And so what you can do is look at, you know, which outer automorphism G1 maps into, which one G2 maps into, and which one G1, G2 maps into, and you construct the usual inverse thing. And that has to be a conjugation by H. So basically you have a function, H-valued function of two group elements, and that's almost a co-cycle. It's a co-cycle up to Z, and the Z depends on 3. Yeah, exactly. So this is the physical setup. So that was only math. Now the physical setup, it turns out that this can be promoted to a physical setup where the physical system, the anions in your physical systems are the quantum double of H. So basically this discrete gauge theory based on H. So this is a system which has anions. The anions are both, you know, there's both charges of H and fluxes of H. There's both of these things.
Here the anion is described by gauge theory. Anion
described by H. Exactly. Absolutely. And it's a non-abelian gauge theory because H is non-abelian. It has to be in order for this obstruction business to give something non-trivial. But that's what it is. And so it turns out that in this setting, this group data that I described on the previous slide, this map from G to outer automorphisms of H, actually induces an action of G by braided autocovalences. So the thing that I described two slides back. Exactly. Yeah. So that's one, you know, so it seems like that's well defined on conjugate classes. And in fact, it gives a well defined action on everything. So roughly the point is that, there was this quotienting out by this wasn't quite an action by automorphisms of H. There was this quotient by interim automorphisms, like conjugation by H. And the point is that, well, in this H gauge theory, that's precisely the point. You know, these interim automorphisms, these conjugation by H, really corresponds to gauge transformations. You know, so physical particles correspond to conjugacy classes, and this turns out to be a well-defined group action. Okay, good. And it turns out that in this sort of physical example that we've promoted to, this H3G. A invertible obstruction that I discussed earlier is precisely given by this group theory obstruction. Actually, there's a map, so you have to think of the center of H as being a subset of the abelian anions. It basically corresponds to fluxes of the center. Okay. Good. So we have a class of physical examples. There are these discrete H gauge theories. And in fact, you know, we can make this really concrete. So I just wanted to throw this slide up there. It is, I think, the simplest example that I know of such an obstruction. So it corresponds to the dihedral group on 16 elements. Okay. So this is basically spatial symmetries of an octagon. There's a 45 degree rotation and a reflection. You know, these are the group relations. So build a gauge. It's a non-abelian group. Build a gauge H gauge theory based on that. center is Z2, consists of just the 180 degree rotation. So I claim that this is a non-trivial example. So I have to, you know, in order to do this, I have to compute the outer automorphism group of this guy, of D16. Turns out that that's Z2 cross Z2. Turns out that I can focus on just one of these Z2s. And this particular, so my symmetry group is just going to be Z2. And the non-trivial automorphism in this Z2 acts this way on the generators. Okay, this turns out to be an example with an obstruction. Okay. You can check that if you act with sigma twice, you don't get the identity back, but you do get an inner automorphism. You get something that's a conjugation by a to the minus 3. So this is a valid map from G to the outer automorphisms of H. Okay. So that's the setup. So we have this class of examples with these anionic symmetries that you know seem to be valid symmetries. They respect all the structure, braiding, fusion, whatnot. And yet there's an obstruction to realizing them physically. So the question is sort of, what's the physical interpretation of this? How can this be? Is there a physical interpretation? I mean, maybe there isn't, but okay, so it turns out that there is. And to explain that, let me actually make contact with an earlier story that also has to do with obstructions, but it has to do with a different obstruction. So this story is still in, we're still talking about 2+1D, gap systems with topological order and symmetry action. But in this setting, and again, we're looking at these braided G-crossed extensions, suppose for a moment that this action by braided autoequivalence is pi hat that we chose is not obstructed. You know, I compute the obstruction and it vanishes. So, you know, I can take the next step. And in fact, I can really illustrate things in the case when pi hat, this action by braided autoequivalence is trivial. It's just sort of easier to talk about that case. It still has all the general properties that I need. So even if this action by braided autoequivalence is trivial, you can have non-trivial braided G-crossed extensions, and you can have another kind of obstruction. So what do I mean? Now, obviously, if pi hat is trivial, the action of G on the anion labels, doesn't do anything. Obviously, there's a completely trivial phase where basically, it's a phase that's built on sort of singlets of G, where the anions in the group don't talk to each other at all. But you can have something more interesting, and that more interesting thing, and Michael sort of made contact with this in the previous talk, has to do with fusing fluxes of G. So. Think about these fluxes of the symmetry. So these are symmetry fluxes that Michael talked about. It turns out that when you fuse such fluxes, in the completely trivial case, a G flux and an H flux fuse to a GH flux and nothing else. But you can have something more non-trivial where these fusion rules are somehow deformed. And when you fuse a G flux and an H flux, you actually get an additional anion in your original theory. Okay. So really, I have to be a little more careful. What do I mean by a G-flux? I mean, in particular, because a G-flux isn't uniquely defined. It's sort of uniquely defined up to fusion of anions. So I have to, choose a representative, and there's actually an ambiguity in the definition of this additional flux AGH. So there's this sort of ambiguity in this definition of A. And furthermore, there's some constraints on what this additional anion could be. It has to satisfy this equation. So then that just comes from associativity. It's the cocycle equation from associativity. And so really, A defines a cohomology class in H2G valued in the abelian anions. Okay. Turns out that this anion always has to be abelian. Okay. Good. So you can think that you can characterize symmetry-enriched phases by these kinds of classes, okay, and physically, what this really means, if you think about, what braiding of defects means in terms of like projective quantum numbers carried by anions, it really means basically that anions carry projective representations of G. But okay, so you might think that there's a sort of symmetry enriched phase in 2+1D corresponding to any one of these guys, but it turns out that that's not the case. This is the second obstruction in the construction of braided G cross categories, some such fractionalization classes, H2G of A, are, this should be A invertible, are obstructed. There's a well-defined map into H4G coefficients with U1, which tells you when the obstruction is non-trivial. Okay, and this is the sort of, I guess, called Pontryagin square or something like that. There's a well-defined such map. And what this has to do with basically is the fact that, you know, even though you have this class A, so even though you've defined a fusion for fluxes and this fusion is associative, the associativity isomorphism might not satisfy the Pentagon equation. There might be some irremovable U1 phase which you know, you just can't get rid of, and that prevents realization purely in 2D. And so this actually does have a physical interpretation. This is our work from a couple of years ago, where basically we showed that this, you know, such, and Michael mentioned this at the end of his last talk, but basically these kinds of obstructed actions of symmetry in 2+1D can be realized at the surface of 3+1D SPT. And, you know, really the hint that this happens is just this mathematical obstruction. This mathematical obstruction, H4G of U1, is the same group that classifies, you know, according to this classification of SPTs, it's the same thing that classifies 3+1 SPTs. So that sort of gives you the hint. Okay, so now let's go back to the current story and let's see if we can interpret this first obstruction. Okay, this obstruction valued in this H3 group that has to do with the anionic symmetry. I don't think it has to be, no. Well, in all my, like in my example, it will be, but
H is in general non-abelian.
H is in general non-abelian. I don't think there's constraints on G. Yeah, I think it's general. Okay, I mean finite, but good. So good. So now let's go back to this kind of obstruction. So okay. So what can I say about this? You know, if you go to into the, you know, this actual construction of braided G cross categories, I haven't really told you exactly how this obstruction arises, but roughly the way it arises is that you know, as opposed to the previous case that I discussed, when you can get an associative fusion product for fluxes that just, you know, the associativity isomorphism happens to fail, you know, not satisfy the Pentagon equation, in this case you can't even find an associative tensor product for fluxes. There's always some kind of an irremovable anion ambiguity, abelian anion ambiguity that you know, you just can't get rid of. And so what this suggests is that, you know, I mean, this is sort of physically vague, but roughly it seems to suggest that if you do this associativity isomorphism, there's an anion that comes in out of nowhere. So if you were thinking about doing a realization of the surface of something, it suggests that there's something that can go into the bulk. Okay? And this is strange, and this causes some problems, but that's what it seems like. So, and in particular, for this Eilenberg-MacLane class of examples, this ambiguity is always valued in the center fluxes, the fluxes of the center, which are always, you know, bosons. And so it just suggests that these bosons, you know, if you try to construct a realization of this thing at the surface of something, you should be looking at maybe 3+1D systems, which are not SPTs, but which have topological order, and the topological order is that of a Z gauge theory. So that, you know, where the Z gauge charges correspond to these guys.
But this fusion is done on the surface.
Yeah.
2+1D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So so let me leave the first thread now, and let me talk about the second thread because this is, you know, this sort of motivates looking at these 3+1D symmetry inner spaces. So for this second thread. Let me look at these 3+1D symmetry in your face. Yes.
Yeah. So this A is the line because no braiding on the boundary.
Yeah, so that's gonna be an issue because there are quasi-particles in, you know, like in these quantum doubles which do braid non-trivially with A. So something has to happen to them. And it'll turn out
the A itself does not have any non-trivial braid.
There are quasi-particles in this obstructed theory. There are quasi-particles which braid non-trivially with A, so something will have to happen to them if we do such a realization. I haven't said what the realization is yet.
If I take A to the bulk and then I bring it back.
Yeah, yeah. So the particles which have non-trivial braiding with A, with the center fluxes, turn out to be confined to the endpoints of gauge fluxes. Yeah, exactly.
Can I make a comment on this?
Yes.
I discussed it with Ryan, but we never published anything. So this, in the previous case, when the H4 obstruction was on zero, the bulk was an SPT case. So
correct.
The realization on the boundary of an SPT case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When this obstruction is on vanishing, the bulk should be not an SPT case, but generalized SPT case. And that a class in H3 tells you
yeah.
what sort of while Z is going to be this one-form case, one-form symmetry. And the class tells you how this is entangled.
And it has to be non-trivial gauge to the bulk. A is rather the
mind
of that.
No, Z.
A is Z.
No,
little A is Z.
Little A.
Yeah.
Right. So there's
a gauge is in the Wilson line.
I have to think that your language might have like a two-form gauge field instead of a four dimensions, two-form gauge field and one-form gauge field. You also are thinking about a two-form gauge field, which couples to this, well, one-form symmetry. So that's.
Yeah, so what I'm going to talk about is basically a Hamiltonian realization of that.
Yeah. Before, when you had all these abstractions, the symmetry could have been a global symmetry. But for A to be really a quasi particle that can wander into the bulk, it should better be a gauge
symmetry. G should be a gauge symmetry?
No,
ZZ. ZZ, yeah. Absolutely, Z, and it will, yes.
But before Z was not gauge.
No, you could have it.
Yeah.
It could be a one-form symmetry. Yeah, it's a one-form symmetry. One-form global symmetry.
Global or gauge?
And then the global. Stage three.
One from global.
Stage three is the first metal class, mixing the G symmetry and the Z one from symmetry. Then you can have this realized on the boundary of the
relationship.
So what do we give in the bulk?
Well, I'm about to describe the bulk. Maybe I'll get a couple slides in and we can discuss further.
Both zero from global symmetry and one from global symmetry.
Maybe
I
have another question on this, try to clarify.
Okay.
So this FTH actually corresponds to a symmetry twist of the global group. But this A presumably is kind of purely surface anion, not involving with any symmetry twist.
Yep. And it's a surface anion of Z, in fact, of the center. You know, so it's a very special surface anion, which can be. Okay, so the bulk is a Z gauge theory. It's a gauge theory of this group, center group, which is an abelian group. So it's an abelian gauge theory. It's useful for me to think of it as the gauge theory of the dual of Z, so maps from Z to U1. Just because ultimately, what I want to do is identify the gauge charges in the 3D bulk with the surface fluxes. Gauge charges are typically the representations, so they're really representations of Z star. So there's this sort of duality. So these are the excitations, gauge charge, gauge flux, and the important thing is that braiding one around the other gives you a U1 phase. So Z evaluated on Z star.
I didn't totally understand this at all. What's the gauge between the bulk? Say Z,
yeah.
Z star.
Z star.
That's an ordinary gauge.
Yes.
And the blue dot is what would denote the value A4.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It is in a representation of Z star.
Yeah.
So that's what you call gauge charging Z?
That's a gauge charge of Z star. And that's like a surface flux of Z.
But is it a representation of Z or is it?
Representation of Z star, which is an element of Z.
It's a question of terminology, I guess. But yeah. When you say gauge charge, when you say an electron is a gauge charge for electromagnetism,
you mean
it's a representation of the gauge.
Yeah.
So the blue dot, is it in a representation of Z star?
Yes,
or Z?
Z star. Yeah, which is an element of Z.
Because you wrote here it's a gauge star.
Yeah, it's an element of Z, which you think of as a representation of Z star.
It's a related symbol in backslash Z star.
Yeah.
So if this is Z related, is the center of the global symmetry group G or just a...
No, center of totally different thing. It's center of H, which is describes the surface topological. Yeah.
Oh, I see, center of H.
Yeah, good. Okay, so far, I've just talked about topological order in 3+1D, or a certain class of topological orders, these Z star gauge theories. But let's talk about symmetry fractionalization now. If you impose symmetry, what kind of different symmetry enriched phases can you have? So, as I said before, symmetry can permute the labels associated with various loops or points or whatever. These gauge charges might carry fractionalized representations of G. But the other possibility that's not available in 2+1 is that the flux loops might behave as the edges of 2+1 DSPTs. Okay? And this is actually captured in this 3-loop braiding that Michael talked about if you sort of gauge everything. But I want to think about it in this way for now. So I want to talk about a symmetry fractionalization where the flux loops of Z star behave like SPTs, 2+1 D SPTs. of the relevant global symmetry, which is G. So typically, to classify SPTs, we look at this group cohomology class, H3G valued in U1. But now there's some constraints, because if I have, Z1 star and Z2 star different gauge flux loops, if I fuse them together, the SPT corresponding to that has to be sort of the stacking of the two SPTs corresponding to Z1 star and Z2 star. So there's some kind of constraints imposed. And basically those constraints tell you that the overall symmetry fractionalization is characterized by H3 of G valued in this discrete group Z. Okay, it is Z, not Z star in this case. Now, this is precisely the group that occurs in the Eilenberg-MacLane obstruction. So the conjecture is that you can realize these obstructed discrete age gauge theories that I talked about in 2 plus 1D, the first thread, at the surface of such 3 plus 1D Z gauge theory. Okay, and so it turns out that's precisely what happens. We have an exactly solved model which realizes this, the intuitive idea behind this exactly solved model is precisely what I already mentioned, is that you identify the surface Z fluxes, these surface anions. So all the excitations that I've drawn here, loops and points, are sort of intrinsic excitations. I haven't drawn any G fluxes or any symmetry fluxes. But the idea is that you identify these surface fluxes of Z with gauge charges in the bulk, which are irreps of Z star. Okay, so they're also given by elements of Z. Now, if you make this identification, the important point is that any surface quasi particle which sort of feels the center of H, which feels the Z, which has non trivial braiding with such a quasi particle, with such a Z flux. It can't exist as its own deconfined excitation on the surface, because you can always sort of take Z into the bulk, and then you'll see that you reduce that braiding to nothing continuously. And so what must happen, it turns out, is that it must such a quasiparticle which is not transparent to Z must be bound at the end of a bulk gauge flux. Okay, and then everything's consistent. You can do the braiding on the surface, and you just get the phase from the center flux braiding with the quasiparticle, or you can take everything into the bulk, in which case you get the phase of Z with this gauge flux, bulk gauge flux loop. Okay, so then everything's consistent. And in fact, we have an exactly solved model of this, which is kind of nice, and it's kind of a nice construction. It was actually originally done by Hermele in the case of 2D symmetry enriched phases, and there was no sort of obstruction or anomaly story there. It was just realizing very specific classes of symmetry enriched phases in 2D. And the exactly solved model is basically, given a symmetry group G, you just take mod G layers of your gauge theory, and you construct this sort of weird lattice, which has, the usual horizontal links, which just corresponds to, your 2 plus 1D discrete gauge theory, but it has some vertical links as well. Which also turn out to carry H labels, okay? Because H isn't discrete H gauge theory; everything carries H labels. And it turns out that you can implement the symmetry action very simply. It's basically permutation of the layers. The layers correspond to elements of G, and there's just a natural permutation of layers. There's natural induced action on these links, and basically all the sort of non-trivial symmetry enriched phases, all the information is encoded in certain H fluxes that you put through these sort of degenerate plaquettes, these degenerate extra plaquettes. So if the symmetry is Z2 and something carries a half charge of Z2, acting with that Z2 twice sort of brings you around this plaquette, and you get a minus sign. But this is a very sort of general kind of idea. So this is what we did. We constructed a surface lattice model for this obstructed theory. Now the theory is obstructed, so there better not be a regularized model that realizes it with symmetry. And so it turns out what happens is actually there's an extensive degeneracy. Similarly, we constructed a 3D bulk model of the phase that I just talked about with the fractionalization along flux loops. It turns out to have a surface with extensive degeneracy. It turns out that you can get rid of those degeneracies by coupling the two. So this is the sort of realizations. Let me just say a couple of words about this 3D bulk model. So the 3D bulk model is a generalization of this idea of Hermele to looking at basically fluctuating membranes in the 3D bulk. And the reason, you know, this is just some dual representation of the Z2 gauge theory. I mean, I could have looked at fluctuating strings, which are just dual representations, but it turns out that this, it's nicer to look at it in terms of fluctuation, you know, fluctuating membranes as dual picture, because that lets you directly access these gauge fluxes, which in this picture are just the boundaries of these membranes, okay? Because you want to specify fractionalization along fluxes, and this lets you directly access that. Okay, so that turns out there's a nice 3D bulk model. They sort of mesh together really nicely. You know, let me just mention a couple subtleties associated with this construction. So one subtlety is that, you know, if you look at the surface of our 3D bulk model, it actually also has some trivial gap surfaces. So it's not like you can say that, oh, you know, the surface of this 3D Z gauge theory must always be non-trivial. It turns out that you have some trivial gap surfaces which basically correspond to a Higgs condensate of these Z charges. So you can condense the Z charges. That's fine. You know, in that case, you have a surface condensate of these Z charges, and then the gauge flux lines are confined. They can't even end on the surface. That's sort of a valid class of surfaces. So the model that we wrote down realizes this other class of surfaces where basically what happens is that you know, it's like on the other side of this surface, the gauge fluxes have condensed instead of the charges. Okay, so the gauge fluxes can end at the surface. Okay, so that's one point. Another point is, you know, you might try to make this a little more general. You might try to say that, okay, fine, you know, let's look at just these surfaces where you don't have this surface Higgs condensate. You're looking at the class where gauge flux loops can end. So then you might want to say, well, the surface termination of such a 3D Z gauge theory must always be anomalous. In fact, it's a little tricky. So the point is that you know, the groups in which the 2D obstruction and the 3D SCT topological symmetry inverse topological order are valued are slightly different. So one takes coefficients in, you know, for this well, the bulk one takes coefficients in Z. You know, which is the dual of the gauge group in the bulk, and the surface one takes values in these invertible anions. So in general, there's some map, you know, there's some identification of these bulk gauge charges, IRFs of Z star, with the surface anions. And the point is that, you know, in the class of examples we consider these things based on the Eilenberg-McLean obstruction, this map is always an inclusion. Nothing goes to zero, but it turns out there's some other surfaces that you can write down in which, you know, you don't have a surface obstruction, and it's because this map is actually zero. So like sometimes, you know, there's an example where this is Z2 and this is Z4, for instance, and that if G is also Z2, induces the zero map, it turns out. So you have to be a little careful about that. So okay, so I'm almost done. Let me just have two more slides. So one sort of conclusion slide and one extensions slide. So as far as conclusions, you know, this is nice because it at least lets us have some physical understanding of this obstruction that arises in classifying 2D symmetry inverse phases. We had a physical interpretation for the other obstruction. There's basically only two, so it's sort of gratifying to have a physical interpretation for the first class of obstructions, you know, albeit in some restricted class of models. It's not completely general. And so actually, that takes me to this. This is the final slide, which is sort of how can we extend this? So you know, one of the biggest issues is, you know, we really consider just this restricted class of models, and so you know, you can try to generalize in various ways, but you might run into problems. So if you look at sort of a general unitary modular tensor category, and you look at this obstruction, it's typically, you know, it's all you know about it really is that it's valued in the invertible anions, in the invertible objects, in the abelian anions. Now, if some of these are not bosons, or maybe, you know, more generally not bosons or fermions, you know, some anions with really weird rating, abelian, but you know, maybe some really weird phases which are not plus or minus one. Then trying to construct this 3D bulk into which they can go is very problematic because, you know, in 3D bulk, point particles can really only be bosons and fermions. So, I mean, one of two things can happen. I mean, maybe something really weird happens, or maybe this obstruction color always taken to be valued in bosons and fermions, or basically things which are self-bosons. I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe some obstructions cannot be resolved.
Yeah, exactly. That's all right. That's the second.
It can resolve using this generalized symmetry pipeworks.
Yeah, so that I'd like to understand that. Okay.
What is
Well, so yeah, so that's going to be point three. Let me just make one other point. So I mentioned that, so in this class of examples that I constructed, everything's a boson that goes into the bulk. But you can imagine that, you know, there's this possibility that some of these bulk quasiparticles could be fermions. So maybe there's some examples like that. And this could actually be especially useful because, you know, maybe there's only one quasiparticle and it's a fermion and goes into the bulk, one quasiparticle in Z. So then in the bulk, you have a topological order, which is a Z2 gauge theory where the gauge charge is fermionic. That's something that you get from gauging fermion parity in a fermionic SPT. So maybe this could be a useful way of describing fermionic SPTs. And in particular, there's this class of 3D topological superconductors, this Cartan class D3, where such a thing might be applicable. I mean, that involves anti-unitary symmetries, G time reversal anti-unitary symmetry. So this idea in terms of symmetry fluxes might not work, but the whole story might, there might be some way of carrying the story through. And then finally, there are these relations to higher forms, the higher form symmetries in this higher form symmetry framework, which unfortunately I'm not super familiar with, but maybe that's something we can talk about. Okay, so with that, I'd like to end and then take questions. Thanks.
Yeah. We have this example with the dihedral.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So there are two questions. One, do you have an example with the abelian group where H is abelian? Second, why did you have to go to such a high? You said this was the simplest example. What is it that is not?
Yeah. So I don't think there are. Groups? Yeah. So I don't think there are abelian examples.
No, it can't be abelian because in that case the inner automorphism is bigger.
Then G will have to usual
automorphism.
Yeah, right. Right. That's extendable. You can always write that.
Because we're looking for some special classes, some special obstruction. It's called Elmer-McLane obstruction. That other ways to get, non-trivial classes in H3, right? Not just from this Eilenberg-McLane construction. That was the only reason H was non-abelian. You can't have an element in H3 of G, which is an A, can be non-trivial even both when G and A, everything is.
Yeah, but how do you obtain that element?
Well. The point is that it's an architectural construction, but
yeah.
your obstruction came from some non-trivial action of the group on anions.
Right.
And that doesn't have to be that. So that's the only reason for it's all non-abelian.
Yeah.
I thought we already know the answer to your first question. You said it wanted to be in bosons. So we have an example with the semion, right? We have a non-trivial obstruction for a semion with a Z2.
Oh, no, but that's an example of a different obstruction. So you mean this chiral semion of the surface of SPT? Yeah, that's H4. Yeah, there's that's the semion that carries like the symmetry group Z2 cross Z2, and the semion carries some weird projective charge of Z2 cross Z2. So that's an H4. Yeah.
Can I make a comment? Okay. So item 1 and item 3 are closely related. In this slide.
Oh, yeah?
So, and in fact, three answers one.
Uh-huh.
And I claim that there's always the way you explained it, you had a bulk fade, which is a gauge theory, that is a topological order.
Yeah.
And the boundary
exactly.
Was some weird symmetry.
Yeah.
Alternatively, you can say that you can take the bulk to be an extra SPT fade, but the general SPT fade, the higher form global symmetry.
Uh-huh.
In that case.
So the higher form symmetry would be Z?
Yeah, so, right. And then you can show it also answers one in the sense that for any obstructions,
uh-huh.
Even in the case when your elements in H3 are not above, and because not just in the boulder, you can always have
uh-huh.
Generalized SPT phase in the bulk.
So there's I can do this in the Hamiltonian framework where I can just write down
well,
some one form.
Hamiltonian form.
But in principle, it should be.
Yeah. 50 action on the lattice,
yeah.
Which you can, from which you can extract that Hamiltonian projector Hamiltonian.
I see. So it's just not an on-site sort of tensor product action.
It does like on-site.
Yeah, okay. I think we were looking at these Walker-Wong models, and from that you can also do a similar construction.
Yeah.
And basically you get something that's not an on-site action. Yeah.
Just engaging Walker-Wong.
Yeah.
I'd like to add to that comment if I may. So when you have a G domain wall, when you're thinking about gauging G, you're going to be multiple equilibrium, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your domain wall is composed of, say, like three elements of G, X, Y, and Z,
mm-hmm.
and it splits up into X times Y and Z,
mm-hmm.
and then X, Y split up, and then they associate.
Yeah.
Reform, that's a co-dimension 2 defect
mm-hmm.
living on the domain wall. And when the domain walls proliferate, so will these co-dimension 2
uh-huh.
defects. And these are the symmetry defects of this higher form Z symmetry.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I'll have to think about it, but yeah, that sounds right.
So mathematically, when you define this abstraction, can you generalize to any unit group if the G is any unit?
I mean, you can generalize the groups. You can write down the groups.
The question is that when you're talking about this kind of H3 obstruction, can I think about the G as anti-unitary group instead of unitary
group? So you're trying to construct extensions by anti-unitary groups.
Anti-unitary.
Like Hamming-Russell symmetry.
So the point is that group,
but it's acting differently. It's acting on space-time, reverses orientation of space-time.
It
might be, I don't know, if G have non-trivial action on this A.
Reverses the braiding. Instead of preserving the braiding, it reverses the braiding.
So you said that if there is an abstraction, then you can interpret this as extending to 3+1 with some gauge theory. And can you interpret this in terms of the theory of monoidal two categories?
I don't really know anything about monoidal two categories, I'm sorry.
Because it seems like this should be monoidal two categories.
Maybe Anton can.
Can you do what? Can you interpret this theory of extension to 3+1? We're used to thinking that when we go up in one in dimension in the physical model, this corresponds to going up the categorical ladder.
Yeah. Mm.
So this should be related, since we are in 2+1, we consider extensions by groups of monoidal categories, braided monoidal categories, modular categories. Maybe there is a similar game at the level of two categories, which corresponds in category theory to this physical model.
Yeah, the loop operators are talking about the loop.
Right. So what I'd like to see what the categorical formulation of this state.
Definitely, because these are derived euro-like construction of this D2 gauge theory. And if you reform in that shape, probably you'll see a monoidal category, right?
Maybe there is some kind of four-dimensional TQFT.
But in this case, Lucas was talking about this very special 3+1-dimensional TQFT. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about, I guess, is much more general, because gauge theories would fit into this framework, but
So just wanted to see what kind of problem in category theory this is solving.
That'd be great.
The general four-dimensional theory will assign to the circle
that happens. It's a meeting we have a theory.
The modular tensor category will all be like a place of monoidal two category.
We're making okay. Yeah.
So you're talking about symmetric fractionalization in the bulk of the loops.
Yeah.
So you were assigning kind of an SPD space. Like H3 or G, and then you said that it's like in Z because that has to have a fusion. But do we actually understand like the general structure of? I mean, it seems like you're now going towards classifying SETs in T+1. Are there like additional constraints that those things need to obey?
Additional constraints. Oh, yeah. So you're asking like, well, given a choice of fractionalization class H3, G of Z, maybe there's some anomaly or some obstruction too. Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I guess what Shichen and Mike Hermley had some paper about such obstructions that might be related. I think there can certainly be obstructions of that form. I mean, I focused on a very particular example, which was happened to be unobstructed in 3D, in 3+1.
I think you should. Thanks.